being in touch with Rabbi Khan and knowing that he's going to be here, and a work-related family in the West Coast, and having the opportunity to bring him down here. Does anyone? This is not Rabbi Khan's first time to San Diego. Does anyone remember?
It's gone on resident.
Anyone remember when? How long ago? Ooh.
8 years ago.
Okay. A little more than that. Right? What was it? 2008. 2008 approximately. Okay? We're not going to test you to see if you remember what he spoke about then. Okay? But tonight we have a very special, unique opportunity and to have Rabbi Khan here and his Rebbetzin also from Eretz Yisrael. And they're going to thank the Richards for hosting them tonight and for having them speak tonight. Rabbi Khan is a multifaceted, unique individual, a person who really has touched in Torah all elements, all aspects of Torah, whether it's hashkafa, it's musar, halacha, the right, the left, center, all areas. And when you have his writings, the very deep understanding, and if I would go through his biography, his bio, you would see his life is also very colorful from many of the different places that and different individuals that he learned with, beginning with the Yeshiva Ol Moshe in Brooklyn. And is it still there? I think it's still there. And going on to what's called the BTA, which is Olava Shalom also. It's a defunct BTA, is the high school in Brooklyn of Yeshiva University. It was the counterpart of MTA, which still exists. And also, before that, it was in Yeshivas Chaim Berlin. And was Rav Huttner there? It was a great Rav Huttner. And then he made his way to Eretz Yisrael and learned by some of the great Rabbanim there. And back to Yeshiva University, to Rav Soloveitchik, and then back to Eretz Yisrael, the Gruz Kol, and the many, many tutors of many great leaders and really teachers of our generation. To ask Rabbi Khan to speak about something, you know, well, what's the topic list? Okay, well, you think the Megillas Esther is long? This is much, much longer than that. It's a Megillah, you get all your choices. Anyway, we have come up to the topic of discussing. The title tonight is Halacha in the 21st Century and really understanding the halachic process. There are many challenges to halacha. You know, people don't necessarily understand it or don't enjoy it. They don't like it, for that matter. So hopefully Rabbi Khan will be able to just enlighten us on some of those points. Again, I do want to thank him for being here this evening. And if anyone has any questions afterwards, of course, they'd definitely be able to entertain. So once again, without further ado, Rabbi Ari Khan.
So thank you for the kind introduction. So the truth is, introduction is my favorite part of the... I mean, it's the only part I don't know what's going to be said. But it was very interesting because he used the word halacha in the 21st century, and the topic we actually agreed upon was Judaism in the 21st century. Oh. No, but that's very good. It's very good.
Freud is slow.
Right? You're not the only one. It's not just Freud. Rabbi Soloveitchik used to call halacha, he would call it yahadus. He would say, this is, or the other way around sometimes as well. What is yahadus? It's halacha. And from halacha, he felt that there was an incredible amount of, I don't know what other word to use, is that from halacha we understand Judaism. And for some people, you know, you spoke about multifaceted. When it comes down to it, there's only one facet, and it's all-encompassing. I'll say one thing about this week's parsha, and I'll probably say it again on Shabbos, but I won't be here, and I suspect most of you won't. There's an incredible, incredible teaching of the Vilna Gaon. This week we read Parsha Mishpatim. I don't know, in Chutz La'aretz, is it Parshat Mishpatim or Parshas Mishpatim? I don't know. Okay. You'll tell me what I'm supposed to say. But I'm speaking in English. So this week is Parshas Mishpatim. So in Mishpatim we have a lot of law, but we don't follow all the law exactly the way that it's written. So one of the laws, right, which is interesting, one of the best lines, I'm not going to talk about politics, I know, I'm not going to say anything about politics, for many reasons. One is I don't care, but that's there are other reasons. And I'm certainly not going to talk about American politics, because then I don't know if I care, I don't even understand what I don't care about. But I saw in the days leading up to the election of President Trump, that there was a wonderful turn of phrase that I don't know who the first one to say it. You can look this up because it's important. Saying that the people who are supporting him and the people who don't support him or attack him, that they had a fundamental difference. Those that support him take him, don't take him literally, but they take him seriously. And the others take him literally, but they don't take him seriously. And no, I thought that was just a profound statement, but I think that the same thing is true in terms of Torah. When it comes to Torah, there are people who don't take it seriously, and those are the ones who take it literally. And what I mean by that is, you know, you read a verse and they'll just take it without any Torah Shebal Peh, without any other commentary. Oh, that's what the Torah says. So they take it literally, but therefore they don't take it seriously. And then there are those of us who take the Torah quite seriously, but we don't always take it literally. So, for example, one of the things that it says in this week's parasha is it says that if somebody knocks out someone else's eye, I think what it says, again, I don't want to guarantee that's what it says, I think that it says that you pay an eye for an eye. Now, by the way, I'm not convinced that the words ayin tachat ayin means that you pay, that you knock out an eye for knock an eye. It could be for an ayin, comma, depends on the truck. Ayin, what do you pay? Tachat ayin. So what does tachat ayin mean? The replacement of an eye. So it could be that it never said an eye for an eye, and that itself, the translation, is dependent on how you understand it. But the Vilna, so what's tradition say? Tradition say you don't go knocking out people's eyes if they knocked out an eye, but rather what do? You pay money. How do you say money in Hebrew?
Kesef.
Now that they know.
Mamon. Okay.
Mamon or kesef. Mamon or kesef. So the Vilna goes, so the halacha is, that you pay the value of the eye. Now, one of the interesting issues is the value of whose eye? Then that is an argument of the Talmud. Do you pay the value of the perpetrator or the value of the victim? That if you pay the value of the victim, right? If you pay the value of the victim, it's because, look, he had damage onto him. But if you pay the value of the perpetrator, then what you're saying is that on some level he deserved to lose his eye, but that's considered to be punishment, which is really, for whatever reason, can't possibly be. So rather you'll pay that person who should have lost eye will pay the value. Getting back to the Vilna Gaon. So the Vilna Gaon said the truth is everything is in Torah. And they say towards the end of his life, all that he learned was Torah Shebichtav, the written Torah, because he saw everything there. So he said, what's the punishment that you pay if you knock out an eye? So what does the Torah actually say? I'll say it again. What does the Torah say? Ayin, what do you pay? Tachat ayin. So the Vilna Gaon said like this, what is tachat ayin? So he says, no, literally tachat ayin. Literally tachat ayin. So the word ayin means an eye. The word ayin is spelled ayin yud nun. So he says, what's the letter in the alphabet after the ayin? It's a pei. What's the one after a yud? It's a kaf. What's after nun? It's a samach. Those three letters spell kesef. So he says, ayin tachat ayin is kesef. That's what it says in the Torah. So that itself, again, is really a profound statement, but what he's saying is, no, just take a look how everything is combined. Now, let's get back to Judaism in the 21st century, because I don't want to have complaints that I didn't talk about what I said I was going to talk about, because I've heard there have been such things. We live in very interesting times. I think that if someone would have predicted 200 years ago what the world would look like today, I think that part of the prediction would have been that Orthodox Judaism could not have survived. And I'll explain exactly what I mean by that. In the modern world, in so many ways, things have changed dramatically. And again, I really want to spell this out in clear ways, and then we'll see the challenge that we have and then try to understand how we can possibly deal with it. 200 years ago, for the most part, again, it was breaking down at that point, but Jews, at least in Eastern Europe, still lived in a shtetl. Jews coming from Arab countries also lived, for the most part, in isolated areas. There was not real integration. The breakdown of traditional society should have come accompanied a breakdown of religion. And again, why am I saying this? We were a separate people. We had our own culture. We also had very few choices. There was a real good possibility, unless forced because of the various political and religious elements involved, there was a really good chance that our great or great-great or great-great-great-grandparents were born, lived, and died in the same town. And I don't even know if they knew what the concept of wanderlust was, if they even could have imagined going to different places, maybe in books or so, but people lived in really limited areas geographically. Today, on the other hand, we are nomads. When I say we're nomads in many, many ways. We're nomads geographically and we're nomads spiritually. And I say this as a 20th and 21st century phenomenon, is the amount of movement that takes place. If you were born a couple hundred years ago, you were born into a certain type of wealth, perhaps, and a certain type of family, and the chances of changing that dramatically was almost nil. There were no internet millionaires at that point. You didn't drop out of MIT and then start, you know, some kind of huge company, and before you know it, you were worth a couple of billion dollars or so. That didn't happen in the old days. Which means if your father was a silversmith, there was a good chance that you were going to be as well. And as I'm saying, is that today people are nomads. People now move in all kinds of different directions. That didn't happen in the past, which means it was almost the culture and the society and the economy really forced us to stay in one particular area. And I'll say it again, anti-Semitism helped us in that way, as bizarre as that sentence may have been, and I apologize for even saying it, but it helped us a certain way and it forced us to stay within certain areas. Now, the breakdown of the old society was one which created new opportunities. And when we had these new opportunities, then suddenly, you know, without any of these barriers, now we can move in any direction that it is that we choose. And if we're going to skip now to, again, hundreds of years later and where we are right now, we live in a society where people have a profound sense of personal autonomy, which means I have the choice to make, I have the right to make all kinds of decisions about my life. And if we're going to be very honest, and it's always good to be honest, the concept of personal autonomy, at least on some level, should be absolutely, absolutely against religion. Because religion says there are boundaries, and religion says there are barriers, and religion says that there's someone that you have to obey. Can you imagine that? I believe in my own personal autonomy, and I have to obey certain rules, and the things that I can do, and things that I can't do, and things I'm commanded to do. Which means the idea of religion really can and should be diametrically opposed to the concept of personal autonomy. Which means if you're going to go to one perhaps extreme example, and I'm simplifying this beyond imagination right now, the phrase that we'll hear in various ways, let's say in terms of abortion, my body, my baby, well actually I don't know if any man ever said that, but my body, my baby. So if it's my body, my baby, this is my decision. This is basically, this is me. And how dare someone else come and get involved? And it's very funny that they call this reproductive rights. It's actually not reproductive rights. It's the opposite of that. But is that a true idea in terms of Judaism? And I'm being superficial now because I think the abortion discussion and debate is one which is much more interesting and much more complex than is normally appreciated, but on at least on some level, the concept that a human owns their body, right? A human can do whatever they want with their body. In Judaism, is that necessarily true or is that not true? Is this my body? I can do whatever I want with this. So I'm just saying, is that itself a true concept? But now we're going to realize that if I'm going to speak about personal autonomy and I have these rights, and I have rights to do anything that I want, and you know, what are basic rights? To move. Okay, I talk about being a nomad. To move from one place to the other. Can you imagine how frustrating Shabbat can be? No, you can't go wherever you want on a Shabbat. There's a limit on how far you can even move on a Shabbat. And according to Rabbi Akiva, that's a Torah law. Right? You cannot go all that far. There are limits to this. And this very concept of the limits is one which I think is going to be this huge challenge. So who would have thought that religion would have made it at this point? Who would have, unless there's something really profound and that human beings actually, you know, this is actually true by children, right? They want rules and they need rules and they desire rules. And the children that we just say, no, you make your own decisions, right? Can you imagine a six-year-old? You decide what you're going to eat. You decide when you're going to go to bed. You decide if you're going to brush your teeth. You decide if you're going to cut your nails and on and on and on. I don't think any of us would do that. And I think that the children are raised with rules end up becoming very healthy. So maybe that's an interesting commentary on a society that does not want any rules, really, and whatever happens to that. And it could be that people move towards it. The other thing that I think none of us ever would have been predicted 200 years ago would have been about tshuva movement. Who would have imagined people who have all types of freedoms to say, no, I don't want those freedoms. I would rather have certain rules in my life. And of course, I'm being simplistic because there are other elements around it, including things like believing that there's truth and believing that there's a God and believing that there are ramifications of that. But nonetheless, when faced with limitless freedoms versus rules, who would ever choose rules when one can have freedom? So I'm saying that that's part of what 20th century really needs to face. Today we also live in a time of freedom of information. The freedom of information, in its most extreme sense, is something we just call the internet. And by the way, religious Jews, along with other religions, have a tough time. They don't know what to do with it. I mean, ultimately, if we want to defeat Iran, we should give free internet to everybody over there. Remember the old days that Radio Free Europe?
Yes.
Remember that? And that had an incredible impact because people on the Soviet bloc were able to get information that there's another world out there, again, with certain freedoms they weren't having. And people who are living within a society which is very, very oppressive, to see that there's another larger world out there, that has an incredible impact. But religious Jews, especially ultra-religious Jews, are very, very afraid of the internet. Why are they afraid of the internet? Because, I mean, again, if we'll be very honest, there are certain really, really bad things in the internet, but also there happens to be some really good things in the internet. And ultimately, how do you deal with information? See, let's go back a second. Any time that there's going to be a change within technology, it's going to cause some type of profound impact, perhaps beyond even our imagination. I'll give you an example. It's quite possible, and again, I'm being general, and I don't want to use the word simplistic again, but I'm being general now. It's possible that the division between what we call sometimes the Rishonim and the Achronim, right? Who decided at which point there's a division between the two? Why is somebody before this particular time a Rishon? Why is somebody after this time an Achron? Right? I don't know how to translate into English. Early and late rabbinic authorities, in terms of medieval authorities. We need to draw the line between them. It's quite possible that the division between them is the printing press. That prior to the printing press, if you wanted to learn something, you needed a teacher to teach you something, because books are not really readily available. So therefore, you learned it directly from a teacher. On the other hand, after the printing press, when there are books which are all over the place, at that point, anybody can learn. Just pick up a book and read. But what happens when you read by yourself versus having a teacher who's taught you? There's going to be, again, just a profound change in terms of knowledge and understanding, because there's a real big difference having learned directly from somebody versus having read it in a book by yourself. So therefore, I'm saying it is quite possible that a technological change has caused a division between what we'll call a Rishon and an Achron. And again, I hope that you find that something which is interesting. The telephone, I think, changed things in terms of halacha. I don't know how much you realize that when the telephone was first invented, there were rabbis who gave written opinions saying that a rabbi is not allowed to answer a question over the telephone. Hmm. Now, there's a couple reasons for this. One reason for this is that very often the way the rabbis would get paid is that somebody would come over and ask, okay, I'll tell you. So I can pick on your yeshiva. Okay, soon. Okay, maybe. So Rav Yaakov Weinberg told me the following. He told me that he grew up in the Lower East Side of Manhattan, and he said that when his mother had a question about a chicken, so what would you do? You take the chicken and you go. She said, you can't take the chicken and take either a nickel or a quarter out of it. Remember, it was a small coin. Remember what it was. And then you go over to the rabbi. So I had asked him, here's full disclosure. The reason we had this conversation, this particular question and answer that he gave me, is that I had asked him if he had known my great-grandfather, who had lived in the Lower East Side, and he was a rabbi over there. He was quite well-known. Have you ever heard of Moshe Feinstein? Okay, that wasn't him, but he's part of the story. But he's part of the story. So I asked him if he knew him. So he said there were many rabbis in Lower East Side. So he said that his mother would give him the chicken, give him the coin, and he said most of the rabbis when you come with the chicken, the first thing we'd do before you answer the question is put their hand out, and you'd give them the coin, and then they would look at the chicken. My grandfather, this is the other one, great-grandfather, my grandfather on the other side, grew up in a town in Europe which was called Prussian. The rabbi in Prussian was a rabbi by the name of Rabbi Eliyahu Feinstein. Rabbi Eliyahu Feinstein is an uncle of Rav Moshe Feinstein, by the way, not from the Feinstein side, from his wife's side, because a Feinstein married a Feinstein, but this Eliyahu Feinstein was a Levi, and Rav Moshe's father was not a Levi. Rav David Feinstein was not a Levi, that was his father. And Rav Eliyahu Feinstein's daughter married somebody known as Rabbi Soloveitchik. Okay? So my grandfather grew up in this town. So once one of Rabbi Soloveitchik's grandsons, who today is the Rosh Yeshiva of Torah Vadas, came to my house for Shabbos, and he came in and talked to my grandfather, and he said, "What can you tell me about my grandfather?" My great-grandfather would be, Rabbi Leo. So my grandfather said, Rabbi Eliyahu. He goes, Rabbi Eliyahu is a tzaddik. He goes, why is it tzaddik? I don't want to put any pressure on any rabbis here right now. He said that whenever you would ask him a question again about a chicken, if he passed the chicken, if he said the chicken isn't kosher, he would pay you for the chicken. He says, maybe I'm being too machmir, maybe it's really not halacha, maybe it's not being fair. But he also wanted to encourage people to ask. He also happened to be a wealthy person. I think he owned a tobacco factory. And he was a wealthy man. But anybody who asked him a question, if he was going to say it's not kosher, here's the money for the, let me buy the chicken for you, and you go buy a new chicken. So I'm saying that's really quite impressive to do that. I mean, I'm willing to do this. If you get a raise, were you willing to do this? I was in Back Lawrence last summer. Okay? You want to tell them all what Back Lawrence is like? Not now, but you understand what it is. And they were sitting around the table on Friday night, and everybody there was Republican except for one person, and that was Rabbi Kenny Hain, who was the only Democrat there. So one of the guys says, "I don't know, the rabbi's a Democrat, whatever." I said, "I can solve this for you." And he said, "How?" I said, "Give him a raise. Pay him a lot more money. He'll become a Republican also. What's the problem?" They didn't like the solution. Anyway, the answering of a halakhic question on the telephone was quite problematic, because if you answer on the telephone, then the rabbi's not going to get paid. The rabbi's not going to get paid, which means if somebody's answering it now. By the way, Rabbi Weinberg told me that he would always go to Rav Moshe Feinstein, because, and he said as a little kid, he didn't know that he was smarter or greater or would one day become the Gadol Hador. But again, this is early. This is before Rav Moshe published his first book. He said because Rav Moshe was the only rabbi who never put his hand out for the money before he'd answer the question. He's just, you know, like, say, you know, what's the problem? What's the question? And he would show me, let me look, whatever. And never ask for the money. So Rav Yaakov told me that he just sensed that he was in next to greatness over here, is that he's talking about the Torah and he doesn't care about the money, and therefore he always would go to Rav Moshe with the questions. So again, I don't know, you're writing this down. Good to write that. I don't know if anybody else knows the story. Rav Yaakov told me the story. I don't know if anybody else knows this.
Now you know.
It's good. Good. I'm going to get something out of today. So, but answering questions on the phone is very difficult. And incidentally, I mean, again, also if we're honest, if somebody writes you a question in the mail, you don't necessarily know certain things about the person. And this is also true today in terms of the internet and so on. I get questions from people I don't know who they are. Now, first of all, let me be honest when I answer questions. Would anybody be profoundly disappointed or surprised if I told you that the same people, two people can ask me the same question, I'll give them two different answers? Or do you think that's terribly hypocritical and inconsistent and all kinds of other terrible things?
Not at all.
Why is it fair?
Because some
two different people. There's different things that
right.
are different.
They're two different people.
Someone can...
Right, they're two different people, and therefore the human element means it's not exactly the same question. Because they're two different people. And when somebody asks you a question over the phone, if you don't know that person, then you may not be giving the right answer to that person because you don't know who they are. Which is that was part of the issue in terms of the technology, that now there's a phone. How can you answer questions by phone? And I'll say another thing. If somebody writes you, and then you know the address right back, there have been times that people called me, and this is before you can identify phone calls. Now you can block the phone calls and so on. Do you answer the phone calls that are blocked, or you don't answer them? I don't know. But somebody can call you, and then afterwards, 5 minutes later, hold it. Maybe I misunderstood that, and you want to go back and you don't know how to find them. And that's also an issue. If somebody comes to, listen, we can make mistakes sometimes. We can reconsider. We can think of something else afterwards. And this, and again, technology was something which became an incredible challenge. The internet's a challenge. The internet is full of information. So therefore, if you can talk about Judaism in the 21st century or halacha in the 21st century, people are Google. I don't know. Do you guys Google before you ask your rabbi? I'll ask you another thing. Do you Google before you go to a doctor?
Yes.
Do you Google before you go to a lawyer? Do you trust? See, this is what's important. What's the most important skill that the doctor has? In my opinion, it should be one of diagnosis, which means you are looking at symptoms and you may not be reading them right, and you're going to go and give a diagnosis based upon their symptoms, but you may not know all the information. Correct. But my point... Right, so but again, my point... Again, did you hear my point? The most important skill the doctor should have is one of diagnosis. That should be the skill of why a person went to medical school, to be able to make a diagnosis. I'll say the same thing in terms of a rabbi. That a rabbi should be able to make a diagnosis. Now, very honestly, again, many, many times when people ask me questions, the questions they ask are the wrong questions. You could say to me, what do you mean they ask the wrong questions? You want to get very basic in pots and pans? It generally is going to be like this. Phone's going to ring. Now they can just text you. Phone's going to ring, and the woman's going to say, my stupid husband. That's how it always starts, right? Sometimes they're a little nicer than that. But my husband, but the tone of voice said my stupid husband. It's the same thing. My husband used, I don't know, the fleishik pot to cook something which was parav, and then he put it together with milchiks and whatever, and I poured out the food, and now what should I do with the pot? More often than not, the question like that, if you followed it through, the answer was, well, food was completely kosher, and this is actually a very good shidduch because... Okay, anyway. The food was fine. The food was fine in this case. And sometimes the question in terms of the kalim, in terms of the actual utensils, but I'm not going to trust the diagnosis that the person made, because sometimes they think that's the question, but it's not really the question. And I'll say the same thing over here. When someone's going to make their own diagnosis of what the problem is, and therefore they're going to Google what the answer is, so who's to say the diagnosis was correct? Second problem over here is, who's to say the information they're going to find on the internet is going to be correct? I mean, they say there's something called fake news. I don't know what this is. But is there fake halacha? I'm very serious about this. Which means, who's putting the information over there? Are all... Here, very, very honestly. When I finished Smicha, when I learned for Smicha, I learned the Shulchan Aruch, I went on the tour in the Beis Yosef, and I learned the Shulchan Aruch, and the Shach, and the Taz, and I don't know if I knew what the halacha was. I knew what the Beis Yosef said, I knew what the Torah said, and I knew what the Shulchan Aruch said, and I knew what, assuming the Shulchan Aruch and the Beis Yosef said the same thing, which isn't always the case, and I knew what the Shach said, I knew what the Taz said, I just didn't know what the halacha was. So what's the halacha? Is the halacha like the Shach, or is the halacha like the Taz? I mean, and are all rabbis created equal? Are all opinions equal? Which means just because in the internet it says, oh, this rabbi says this in this case, not all rabbis equal. I mentioned Rav Moshe Feinstein before. So I'll give you a little hint here. If I have an opinion, or if Moshe Feinstein has an opinion, I can assure you his opinion is of much more value than my opinion is. Right? I mean, this is no false modesty. This is just fact. Anything else would be delusional. On the other hand, Rav Moshe's not here, and I have to answer questions sometimes, and he's not here, which creates another problem. But when you see names being quoted in the internet in terms of halacha, it doesn't necessarily mean all that much because you don't know who disagrees. And again, assuming the diagnosis was right, which means the internet is something which is interesting. Personally, I do believe that rabbis should spend a lot more time getting a lot more information up there. We should be you record your shiur? No. We should be recording our shiur, and we should be making them accessible. We should be filling up the internet with positive things, with positive and hopefully true Torah, because if we don't, then it will be filled up with other things. And again, the false modesty on our part, oh, listen, maybe this year is not going to be so good, maybe it's not worthwhile putting it up afterward and so on. We need to fill up the internet in terms of halacha with positive things, that when people Google things, they will be able to find the proper information, because otherwise they will find other things. Just, I'm saying it's as simple as that. Another thing. When I say people don't always know how to ask questions, and again, here we get things which are a bit more dramatic. I mentioned in passing before abortion. I mean, I had a woman called me up, a young woman, who called me up, and the question was about terminating a pregnancy. And she didn't know what to ask. Along the way, I asked the following question. I said, so what does the father think about this? And only then did she think it was of value to mention, oh, the father? Well, I have no contact with him. And I try to draw a little more out. He's sitting in prison. A little bit more. He raped me. All of that was not part of the question that she asked. And all of that came out only afterwards along the way. And again, I'm not going to get into details and thinking or whatever, but all of this was really important information in terms of the question, in terms of the situation. So I'll say it again, people don't always know. And on the other hand, I once was talking to a woman who had an abortion 20 years before, and she was a teenager, and she walked around with guilt for 20 years, and she told me about it, and when she told me the whole situation, I said to her, there were many rabbis who would have supported her decision in this particular case, or whatever the decision, the issues were, and she started to cry, and it wasn't tears of being upset. It was, in a sense, it was tears of joy. You know, she walked around with guilt for 20 years, and that guilt disappeared during this. You know, I know you guys think rabbis can only give guilt. We can also take it away. Very rarely, by the way. We don't like to use that tool all that much. It's
you pay more for that.
You pay much more. You pay much more for that. But again, what a power, what a power this is to be able to take somebody's guilt away. But that's because the question had never been asked and was never asked properly and so on. And I really do believe that that's an issue. But I want to go back to this point in terms of people's feelings of independence today, of people's feelings today that I don't have to ask questions. And it's interesting. I'm a rabbi in a shul which has a very interesting cross population, including people who wear the furry hats. They only wear them Friday night, by the way. I don't know if you ever noticed. By Shabbos afternoon, it's like each davening, each thing, it's less and less clothing. But it's black hats, blue hats, furry hats, kippot srugot, and I'd say everything in the middle. I just don't know what else there may be in the middle. And it's interesting because the more Haredi the population is, the more ultra-Orthodox are, the more likely they are to ask about certain questions. The less, the ones, again, I don't want to stigmatize, but I'm just looking around the population I deal with, the ones that have the more kippot srugot are less likely to ask about certain questions. For example, getting inoculations for a kid. I was asked this week about this. No one with the kippot srugot, as far as I know, would ask such a question. The more Haredi ask in terms of, and my answer is going to be, well, what does the doctor say in this particular case? Now, the doctors, by the way, are okay in every situation. A couple of years ago, I had the following question. A guy came over to me on a Shabbos morning and said to me, I'm a man who's around 60 years, any doctors over here? So at least I'll know who I'm picking on. Okay. So he's around 60 years old. He's telling me he's having chest pains. So there was a doctor right near. So he said, he told me that he was in a car accident on Friday and now he's feeling chest pains. So I said, quickly go to the doctor. Let's just look at you. So the doctor looks at him and whatever. So he comes back and he goes, I said, what did he say? He said that that I should go to a hospital after Shabbos. So I said, that's wonderful, but that's not what I asked the doctor to look at. I asked the doctor to look at me having a heart attack right now. So I called the doctor over and I said, what happened? He said, well, he was in a car accident. So most likely it was the seatbelt that put pressure on his chest and the muscle and so on, and therefore he has an injury, and therefore that's what hurts him. So I said, so what do you tell him? He said, I told him to go to the hospital after Shabbos. I said, if today was Tuesday, what would you tell him to do? He said, I would have told him to go to the hospital immediately. So I said, that's what we mean when we say suffik b'koach nefesh, which means that if there's a potential life and death situation, then you don't look at it as if it should. If you would have told him to go during the week, that means that you'd be concerned that maybe there really is a heart attack, maybe there is something which is more severe. That means that on Shabbos you do the same thing. That's actually, in my opinion, what the halacha is. I hope that no one will disagree with me on that. But I do believe that that's the halacha, is that if you believe as a doctor it's severe enough that you need to go to the hospital immediately, if it's 6 days a week, it's 7 days a week. If you don't have to go to the hospital immediately, so then you don't go to immediately 7 days a week. So that's exactly how I would draw the line. But what's interesting over here is that the doctor felt the responsibility to give a halachic opinion. And I try to make a deal with doctors. I don't give medical opinions. You know why? Because I'm not trained. But that's also what's interesting over here in terms of this whole sense of personal autonomy. So to what extent is somebody going to ask a rabbi? And they do need, meaning, I just want to go back a second. I can't give opinions in terms of medicine. That doesn't mean that in terms of medicine there are not, I hope there are not enough negatives over here, there are not a lot of halakhic considerations. There are halakhic considerations. It just doesn't happen to be that the halakhic considerations are the medical considerations, which means if you do tell me in terms of medicine that there's this possibility, you know, which one do you think is more likely? So there may actually be halakhic issues involved in this, or which procedure, or again, I don't want to get into details over here, but there are consultations that the rabbi needs, that we need to discuss with the rabbi, because there are moral and halakhic considerations as well, and not just medical considerations. And I hope I'm not being too difficult in this. But I want to talk a little bit about something which I think is interesting, and this goes back what I think was a turning moment in terms of personal autonomy in halacha. There was a question that was asked in 1954, and then there was a question that was asked in 1964. The questions have nothing to do with one another except for one thing, and that is that the same person asked them both. That's going to be interesting. In 1954, this person, I'm not telling you who he is yet, asked two different rabbis. One was Rav Breisch. Rav Breisch was a rabbi in Switzerland. Probably in 1964 was one of the most important rabbis in the world at the time. The other rabbi was somebody whose name was Rav Moshe Feinstein, who in 1964, by the way, was up and coming. He published his first book in 1959. He was known in Europe. Rav Moshe was soon to become established as the most important posek in the world. But both of them were asked the same question again in 1954. The question was, could a man dye his beard darker? Or is this considered to be something which is wrong in terms of halacha? Now, what could possibly be wrong with dyeing your hair? So you can say, well, this is something that women do. On the other hand, most women don't dye their beards. So it may not be the easiest argument to make that this is something which women do, unless, and it may depend actually how I frame or conceptualize the whole situation. Trying to look nicer or younger and so on, is this considered to be something which is man, woman, or can I even go and make that statement? But what was interesting, as I said, is that it happened to be that somebody asked this question to two different rabbis. Now that's also should be interesting to some of us. What do you mean he asked two different rabbis? But he did ask, indeed, two different rabbis this question in 1954, and they didn't necessarily agree in terms of the answer. Okay. So in 1964, the same person asked, as far as I can tell, at least three different rabbis. And I saw somebody who had written about this, and in the article he wrote that he strongly suspected that he asked two rabbis. He didn't realize there was a third one, and there may have been more even. Now, this person was a rabbi in Borough Park. So that's why this was a present for Rabbi Volkopolsky. That he was a rabbi in Borough Park. He was a Hasidic rabbi. He was a grandson of the Divrei Chaim, and his name was Rabbi Sholom Yecheskel Shraga Reuben Halberstam. He's known as the Admor Mitzichinov, and I hope I pronounced it properly. In terms of coloring.
Yeah.
If he was wearing a shetel on his face, then certainly. But part of the complexity of this question was that it was being done not with hair coloring, but with some kind of a medicine. I don't know if it's a real, I don't even know if it's real, that you could take a pill that turns your beard, and the question was either black or red. That was also very interesting. You can get a red beard suddenly with, or I don't know, anybody wanted a pill to become a redhead. So it was, that was the way it was created, because he wanted it to be a grumma, so if that helps you at all. So this Rabbi Reuben Halberstam was actually a very big Talmud Chacham. And he wrote, and from what I can gather, over here when he asked three different rabbis, what he really did was, he considered this, and I'll tell you what the question was yet in 1964, but he considered the problem, he wrote his own position paper, you can call it an essay, you can call it a tshuva, call it what you like, he wrote his own position paper, and then he sent it to these different rabbis to ask them what they thought about it. And then they wrote a tshuva about it. Now what was interesting is he asked Rav Breish, he asked Rav Moshe, and he asked Rav Menashe Klein. Rav Moshe doesn't tell you who asked the question, but I'll just tell you the dates involved in this. Rav Breish wrote his answer the 3rd of Tevis 5724, which means the day after Hanukkah. Rav Menashe Klein wrote his answer on the 2nd day of Tevis, the 8th night of Hanukkah. One day after another, we find the two of them responding, and Rav Moshe didn't get around to responding until the 20th of Adar. It took him 2 more months for Rav Moshe to write the answer. Moshe doesn't tell who he's writing to, but the question is absolutely the same question. The question over here was, and I'll tell you, again, I'm more or less how it was framed. Could a girl who's single and having a hard time getting married, who believes that her nose makes her look disfigured, get a nose job?
Yes.
Oh, so all the rabbis here say yes. So that was the question. There was one line in Rav Breish's answer which I thought was so important. He said, to the best of my knowledge, no one has ever asked a question like this before. Which means, here's a question, can I have cosmetic surgery? Can I have surgery which a person doesn't need? Could a person undergo surgery, go under the knife, which has certain dangers involved in it, not because, God forbid, they're sick, not because, God forbid, you need to remove something, but rather because they want to look prettier. And this other element, of course, they need to get married, which again, I think is really interesting. But when I talk about personal autonomy, this becomes a perfect question over here. Can a person choose, I want to look better? So now, the three of them who were asked the question in 64 all say yes, and all for different reasons. See, part of the reason I love this, and if this were a different class or lecture, or time, or maybe even place, we would sit and learn together what they answered and which sources they considered. But it was really like, you know, the famous story about when the Greeks demanded that the Torah be translated into Greek, they took rabbis, put them in 71 different rooms, and they all came up with the exact same translation. Rav Huttner once said, it would have been more impressive if they put all the rabbis in the same room and came up with the same... that would be far more impressive. But each of them independently analyzed the situation, and each said, okay, incidentally, a fourth rabbi who was not asked this question was the Tzitz Eliezer of Waldenburg. He came to the conclusion that he said, absolutely not. It's not allowed. How can a person put themselves in some kind of danger? And any time you go under the knife, there's going to be danger. Certainly with anesthesia, there is some danger involved with it. And he said, absolutely not. And moreover, and he threw in a completely non-halachic consideration, God created this you. How can you rebel against what God did? That is a really interesting argument, but it's I don't want to say it's a non-halachic argument, because obviously he's using it in halacha, but it's sort of what I would call, it's a meta-halachic consideration. And the others don't do it. Rav Moshe basically asked himself, well, why is this not allowed? I can't find why it's not allowed, so it is allowed. That's really what Rav Moshe did over here. Well, Rav Breish was looking for a precedent, which is a parallel precedent, and he found one. And again, completely different approaches to it, but all three of those rabbis were asked this came to the same conclusion that it was indeed allowed. Now, I'm going to say this again. This is a perfect question in terms of personal autonomy, but I want to add two or three other elements. I'm going to finish up now. In terms of why maybe some of this is more complicated, and halacha is more complicated, and why we need to ask questions, and we need to ask questions to rabbis who are competent, who understand how things work in a larger way. The same person who I said that the Tzitz Eliezer, who said, or Voldenberg, who said that you cannot do this because this is against God's will and God created you this way, and Sheker Hachain, Behevel HaYofi, Isha Yiritz Shemaim, right? He said, so therefore, how can you say Eish Yisrael, Sheker Hachain, Behevel HaYofi, and then go and have no surgery? He really says this, by the way. I'm not exaggerating at all. The same rabbi, Rabbi Waldenberg, was extremely lenient, probably the most lenient rabbi in terms of abortion. He allowed abortions into those of you really upset with the New York State law, which was just passed, he allowed abortions, I know personally, into the seventh month. And not because the mother's life was in danger, but because the fetus was extremely damaged. He allowed late-term abortions. But the same person who allowed late-term abortions wouldn't allow a woman to have a nose job. So you say, hold it, what's the correlation over here? On the other hand, Rav Moshe Feinstein would not allow an abortion, absolutely not allow an abortion, unless the mother's life is in danger. On the other hand, the flip side of this, and this to me, by the way, is amazing, there was a really, I think it's a famous case, but there was a tragic case that took place in Lakewood, New Jersey in the early 70s. There was a baby who was born to a family of educators in Lakewood. It was actually not a baby. There were co-joined twins were born, two girls. And they were connected along the side of the bodies. The two bodies were like this. There was one six-chambered heart that the two shared. And there was no way to cut the heart in half. One needed to get the heart. And the babies were flown almost immediately to Children's Hospital in Philadelphia. And the doctor who dealt with this there was a doctor who later became very famous. His name was C. Everett Koop. And recently, all of his papers have been released. So Rabbi Tendler wrote an article about this, telling what Moshe said. And Dr. Koop's articles and his whole files were released as well. Dr. Koop said that the question over here is too complex for him. He was, by the way, a religious Christian. He said it was too complex for him, but once he got to know Rav Moshe, he said, I'm waiting for Rav Moshe's decision on this. Whatever Rav Moshe says, I'm going to follow on this. And the way that Rabbi Tendler quoted it, it was something, I hope I'm quoting it verbatim, it was all the doctors were getting antsy, as it were. They were waiting, every day waiting and waiting, and Rav Moshe still was deliberating. And he said to them, he goes, the morals and the ethics involved in this question is too complicated for me. And he says, I suspect it's too complicated for you as well. But there's a rabbi who lives in the Lower East Side of Manhattan, and he's the one who knows how to answer such questions. And when he decides what the answer is, then I'll know what I'm supposed to do. So that was an incredible thing. Rav Moshe allowed the separation of the kids. Now, again, this is interesting. And this is why we have to be careful. And you can't just say, oh, Rav Moshe is strict and he is lenient. I want you to appreciate why and how Rav Moshe came to this conclusion. Rav Moshe decided that you are allowed to do an abortion if the mother's life is in danger. But under other circumstances, he considered abortion murder. Okay, full stop. So why are you allowed to do an abortion if the mother's life is in danger? Because the mother's life is a real life and the other life is a potential life. But the potential life is living off of the other life. He asked one final question of Dr. Koop. He said, can I cut the babies in half and give the heart to either of the babies? Can I give it to baby A or to baby B? And Dr. Koop said only one of the babies has a chance of surviving. If you keep them together, they'll both die. That's what's going to happen. But if you divide them, only one of them can receive it. So Rav Moshe then decided that the relationship between the two babies was the relationship between a mother and a fetus. He said, obviously then, that the one baby has a heart and the other one is a fetus compared to the other baby, and therefore, just like you can do an abortion to save the mother's life, you can separate the co-joined twins in order to save the life of the other baby, which was really a remarkable decision. Incidentally, the courts...
Who's the mother, who's the
fetus? As he said, the one that could survive... It actually was a little more complex because one not only had a heart, also had a liver, also the other one did. And therefore, it was essentially living off of the life of the other one. So Rav Moshe came to this decision that that's really the mother, and this is just, as a sense, the fetus living off of the mother's life. The courts in Philadelphia, before he was even willing to do surgery, he went to the courts and he asked for a decision that they won't charge him with murder. The court records were closed. Go find them. By the way, this was actually what got me going on this whole thing, to try to figure out what it was that the court possibly could have said. The court records were closed. They were sealed. I believe that they met... When's Veterans Day? So it may have been that on Veterans Day, when the court stenographer wasn't there, is when they went into court. There was no records were kept of it. And therefore, if you look in, any lawyers here want to go start looking this up, there were no records whatsoever. And the court essentially gave a decision that they won't charge him with murder because even though in terms of halacha or American law, this really shouldn't be allowed, but the greater good of society is to allow this to take place. And therefore, the court said, we will not prosecute you, even though they could not figure out why it really was allowed. Rav Moshe figured out why it was allowed, which means Rav Moshe actually went further than the court was able to go, and American law could not figure out why this was not murder. Rav Moshe figured out why it wasn't murder. But I'm saying, again, this is fascinating, because today, for the most part, people will ask these questions about abortion, and people will be asking questions about cosmetic surgery, and so on and so forth, in terms of personal autonomy. These are my choices. This is me. This is who I am. And over here, halacha doesn't always say, no, it's always your choice. Halacha is going to say that there are greater principles over here, but the greater principles over here are not always simple for us to predict what a rabbi is going to say in a case because of the complexity of some of these cases. So my simple conclusion over here, and there's a couple of them. One is we need to study halacha.
So what happened to the babies?
They both died.
Oh.
They separated them. One died immediately, and the other one died a couple of weeks later. We need to study halacha. We need to study halacha seriously. We need, at times, to surrender. This is what's called in Hebrew, Kabbalas O Malchus Shemayim. That realizing that there's a God or recognizing there's a God means that even though we're being raised in a society that tells us that we can make every single decision that we want to make, that's not always going to be the case. Sometimes we need to surrender. I know that in terms of law, we surrender our money when we pay taxes and we surrender our desire to drive faster when we see a cop driving behind us. Not we want to, right? There are times that we're leveraged into certain type of behavior, but understanding that there is a God does cause us to be makabel omal hashemayim and surrender our desire to make all these kinds of decisions by ourselves. And halacha is a system which is incredibly complex, but deals with modern issues. In the last case that I gave, halacha had an ability of dealing with the case that American law could not deal with in terms of its legal complexities. That's something which I think really needs to be thought about, because a lot of people, certainly people that are not within, you know, where we're sitting right now, would look at halacha and they'll sometimes use words like, It's ancient, it's fossilized, it's something which is from the past. It's just not true. Jewish law, probably more than any other place, looks at new issues that come up. I don't know about you yet. I've already given a class, a preliminary class, on using my shul's also, by the way, full of high-tech people, of implications of using Alexa on Shabbos. By the way, the simple answer is no. But you're saying, so how can I say no for 45 minutes? Because there's a more complex discussion over there. But as new technology presents itself, there are going to be new situations and opportunities to learn and to understand and to analyze. And this Torah that God gave us some 3,000 years ago applies just as much to the 21st century as it did to the 21st or the 3,000 years that did prior to this. Thank you. And you all stayed awake. This is actually like miraculous. Thank you very much. You have questions? Or I spoke longer than I said I was going to speak. So I've,
no, exactly.
Exactly. It was good. Yes, sir. Yeah. The difference between living in Eretz Israel versus living in Chutz La'aretz is sometimes the difference of Rishus HaYachid and Rishus HaRabim. Personally, I've been asked questions that could have started World War III. I'm not exaggerating. Am I exaggerating?
No,
Last summer, I'm one of the poskim for a group which is called Zaka. Okay, last summer, Zaka. Last summer, I guess, they deal with they respond to emergency situations, and they're the ones who sometimes are asked to clean up the bodies and the mess after terrorist attacks. There was a terrorist attack on the Temple Mount. So I got a phone call. It was a Friday morning. I got a phone call. Two terrorists are dead. There were two police that were dead as well. We didn't know at that point. The police happened not to. Jewish brothers on the Temple Mount. And I was asked, can Zaka go up to remove the bodies of the terrorists? And I said, if there are any volunteers who went... I said, are there any volunteers who went to mikveh this morning? Then tell them to take off their shoes and to go up to the Temple Mount. Now, the guy who asked me then hesitated, because he asked a different rabbi, and I don't want to say more than I have to, whose answer was, I don't know. And I said exactly what to do. And so he called me back. He said, you sure? I said, of course. I said, do you think there's pikuach nefesh involved in this? And he said, no, I don't share. I'm not sure. I don't know. He said, no, not everything's under control. So I have to tell you another secret. 2 weeks before this, on a Friday night, this is like sometime between Lecha Dodi and Bowie Kala, one of the heads of Zaka who davens in my shul, came over to me and he said there was a terrorist attack by Shar Shechem, and there was a woman police officer who was killed, but at that point she was on the way to the hospital in an ambulance, she wasn't dead yet, and there was a dead terrorist, and the police asked Zaka to remove the dead terrorist, and I said, well, there's no pikuach nefesh, and then the police said they were afraid of riots. So it turns out that they actually had a non-Jewish driver right there, so that was the solution. Non-Jewish driver drove the ambulance and removed the body. So now this is 2 weeks later, and I'm asking, there's dead terrorists in the Temple Mount, and you're telling me that there's no potential for riots involved in this? I do you know the geography over here? Do you know what you're talking about? You know the real estate involved in this? So for me, I had no question at all. That this was the right thing to do, that they had to go up on Temple Mount, they had to defuse the situation, they had to take the bodies away, otherwise there would have been a riot on the Temple Mount. So one rabbi said, I don't know, and I said what to do. So then fortunately, they tried to call Rav Nevensol, who didn't answer. And then they tried him again, then they called Rav Nevensol again, and Rav Nevensol said, if there's any volunteers who went to mikveh this morning, tell them to take off their shoes and go up to the Temple Mount. Okay, so he said word for word what I said. So afterwards, it hit all the newspapers. Rav Nevensol got blamed for it, and so on. There's a lot more. There's a lot more to this story, but I agree with you 100%. Which means over here, a question. This is not theoretical. A question that I was asked. I truly believe that this is something which can spill over to an unbelievable macro situation. And there's many, many more questions like that, and I agree with you completely. It is a huge challenge. Okay? Zell, thank you very much.
Sure. Hope you find enjoy the trip to the West Coast, and they should be well again this year. Everyone coming out.